So there are two ways one can think of how the bulk emerges from the CFT, which roughly I'll call the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg pictures. So in the Schrodinger picture, we would be given some boundary state, and then we would study its entanglement structure. So in particular, we could.
I'd like you to raise your voice to compete with us.
Oh sure. So in this kind of Schrodinger picture, we would be given some boundary state, and then we would study its entanglement structure. So we could, for instance, compute the entanglement entropy of every possible subregion. Then via Ryotake-Nagi, we would know the area of a lot of extremal surfaces. In most cases, enough to construct the bulk geometry. And of course, this will only work, that will only get a sensible geometry for certain special theories and special states.
We should say that reconstructs the one-point function of the metric, but maybe not the
But classical geometry, that's right. So one could say that bulk locality, how it emerges, is hidden somewhere within the entanglement structure. So that's the Schrodinger picture. In the Heisenberg picture, which is older in the context of ADS CFT. One thinks of a duality between bulk operators and boundary operators. So in particular, one could take the field operator, just a scalar field somewhere in the bulk, inside of the circle is the bulk, and ask what the dual is of this operator on the boundary. And the dual of this operator will be called the precursor. So the puzzles of bulk locality. So what does bulk locality tell us? Bulk locality means that there are lots of all the operators that are space-like separated. They all commute.
Too much, but. This distinction you made is an interesting one. I hadn't thought about it before, but these are really very different things. The information contained in the entanglement structure is very different from the kind of information contained in the correlators. Would you say?
Well, you can measure the.
Why is it very different?
Well, because entanglement's weird. It's not a correlation, right?
Up to the complaint I made, which is that the first one is just about classical. Okay. In the bulk, it's classical, and the second one.
I guess that maybe.
So I guess you might say that entanglement shouldn't be enough, because lots of states can have the same entanglement entropy.
Yeah.
But the point is we're discussing classical bulk states, so these are like coherent states.
Okay.
So the parameters by one parameter family. And the same when we construct. This mapping will also be doing it around classical states. So because of bulk locality, there are lots of operators, the space-like separated ones, that commute. And so all these bulk operators are boundary operators, some precursors, and so the puzzle of bulk locality is to understand what in the CFT makes it possible to have so many commuting operators.
Here you're working to leading order in 1 over n, or 0th order or something?
Perturbatively in 1 over n.
Well, as you know, as you go to higher orders, you sort of definition of non-zero commutator.
But that's true.
From the gravitational dressing.
That's right, that's right. But
I guess he's assuming that all the dressing, that they don't cross.
That's his definition of space-like separated, yeah. I think.
Well, except it's harder to achieve that than you naively think.
There's a more informal way of saying it.
Yeah.
The point is, things commute to the extent that gravity allows them to commute, which is a fairly large extent. We know that we have four dimensions, not two, and so lots of things, space-like separated, commute. And then there's the more formal arguments about the gravitational dressing. So, in other words of saying this, there's something in the CFT, at least in the CFT with holographic duals, that such that the algebra of operators of these non-local precursor operators imitates the algebra of local operators in one higher dimension. And so the goal is to understand why. Okay, so the point of the talk will be to present an extremely simple model of precursors, the bulk operators will be dual to superpositions of bilocal operators in the CFT. So this model will be much simpler. Then the real ADS CFT, the real precursors do not look like bilocals, but it will already be sufficient to ask this question of how to generate so many commuting operators in a non-trivial way. So I'll start with the continuum model, which was contained in this paper. And so there we will construct the precursors in the standard procedure, where one evolves the bulk operators to the boundary, and then one uses boundary equations of motion to evolve the smeared local operator to a single time. And here we'll take the boundary theory to simply be a free theory. And we'll do this to leading order. Then next, we're going to repeat or try to construct the precursors, but now take the boundary to live on a lattice. Lattice with n sites. And now we will, in fact, not be able to achieve the same property. We will not be able to create precursors with the required commutation relations that the bulk says they should have. So we'll do this both perturbatively in one over n and non-perturbatively.
Is the lattice where you don't take the continuum limit?
That's right. Just the lattice. The continuum limit was part one. Yeah. Part two is the lattice.
I'm not even sure what I expect for the ground dual of a lattice.
This isn't so much a gravity question anymore.
Right,
it's just a question of, you have a theory, can you construct operators that commute with these and these operators? And it's a little surprising that you can in the continuum, but not in the lattice, in a very different way.
You're not claiming that you can't do it with the lattice. You're just saying that in the model,
in the lattice model,
it doesn't work.
That's right. And this.
Is the extent to which it doesn't work controlled by the lattice spacing?
No.
You recover the continuum?
No.
That's weird.
Okay, and maybe I'll end with some questions. So the model will be in ADS 3, CFT 2. And the theory of the boundary will be the free ON model in the singlet sector. So the dictionary will be that the bulk field maps to the boundary operator O, which will be phi dot phi. Phi I. So the theory on the boundary contains the fields phi I, where I runs from 1 to n, n is larger than the normal n, and the canonical conjugates phi I. And these phi I satisfy the free wave equation. And this is the dictionary between the bulk operator and the boundary operator. So at leading order in 1 over n, one can implement this procedure and construct the precursor.
A standard thing, but I missed it. What's the relationship between the capital phi and the small phi?
The capital phi and the small phi. If you take the capital phi is the bulk field, so if you move it towards the boundary, then it turns into phi dot phi at that point. And so the relation between capital phi at some point somewhere in the bulk and phi dot phi, and the phi's is so as advertised, capital phi in the bulk is dual to a superposition of bilocals stretching between various points on the boundary. So phi dot phi and pi dot pi, and these are some functions f and g, which one can write down explicitly.
Am I just saying 5 seconds about the zero modes? This says the theory is three-dimensional zero operator.
Oh, yeah. So first, we put anti-periodic boundary conditions to not have zero modes.
Okay.
Secondly, we're taking alternate quantization, so we do dimension zero, which actually is not fully legitimate.
Yeah.
Since the range in which you're allowed to do alternate quantization is minus d squared over 4 to minus d squared over 4 plus 1. So this is zero, but we're sitting right at the boundary.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not really justified. But it's too late to change it now, so.
It's not making me sure.
The point, just for simplicity, is there a relation there?
Well, I mean, it's just when you try and write out, if you try and actually understand the bulk theory here, it gets confusing.
So, fair enough. Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's nothing wrong with just doing these manipulations in the boundary theory and seeing that we can capture some aspects of what we expect in the bulk. But I mean, even the aspects having to do with free field theory aren't really captured here.
Well, these functions one can explicitly write down, and then you do have CFT operators which commute just in the way you would expect for bulk operators. So they capture that property.
Yeah.
Which is all we really
need. I doubt this is like a disaster. I mean,
it is true.
The fermion is probably fixes it.
Vlad had a collaborator who had just been doing things in the laziest way possible, basically.
It's true for.
Some people are just irresponsible.
It's true for going to higher orders than 1 over n. This becomes a nuisance because usually when one does the HKLL construction, the fact that the dimension of the operator is greater than 0 automatically ensures that you're satisfying the extrapolate dictionary at higher orders, which here we don't have.
Yeah.
So that does make it confusing. Okay, so this dictionary between the bulk and the boundary is actually much simpler. In momentum space.
So how do you see what the dimension of the operator is?
How do you see the dimension? Phi is a free field, and we're in 1 plus 1 dimension. So it has dimension 0. So this has dimension 0.
Just because d phi squared has to have dimension 2. D squared already has dimension 2. Phi has dimension 0.
So in momentum space, one would take the bulk field and expand it in terms of normal modes, the ADS modes, the omega dk. So omega and k are the quantum numbers. K is the momentum transverse parallel to the boundary, and omega is the energy, and j omega k are just the Bessel functions, the usual normal modes in ADS, and b omega k is the creation operator. So here I've just done normal mode expansion. So this is because we're leading order 1 over n, so the bulk field is free. So this has the free wave equation. One can also expand the boundary fields phi I in terms of modes, since they're also free. So here I've split it into left and right movers. So no tilde means a left mover and tilde means a right mover. And alpha k, for k negative, this is a creation operator. And for k positive, it's an annihilation operator. Just the string theory notation.
It's a free, kind of free theory, right, for boundary, right? And then bulk also expressed in terms of the same free theory operators, right? So then it's like a conditional FNG function, right, that, you know, to have both a kind of like a free theory generically wouldn't be true, right? What is the condition that it is?
Yeah. FNG are very particular, they're fixed, they're very particular functions. That's not what you're asking.
No, but then you can explicitly see that it is both kind of that this capital phi is also like a free field.
Yes. Yeah. This follows from here, because the bulk normal modes, they satisfy the bulk wave equation, box phi equals zero. So that follows from here, and this expansion I just did. So in fact, there's a very clear. So written in momentum space, the dictionary becomes very intuitive. B omega k is alpha omega plus dot alpha tilde omega minus. So B omega k was the creation operator for a bulk particle, and the alphas were the creation slash annihilation operator for the boundary particles. And so the picture is that one bulk particle is dual to two boundary particles, a superposition, really, of two boundary particles. So these two particles, one is moving left with momentum omega minus, the other is moving right with the other one, omega plus and omega minus. And so you can see that the total energy of these two particles is omega plus omega minus, which is just omega. And the relative momentum is omega minus, which is just k.
But both they were on the boundary, right? So they, I mean, momenta were kind of two dimensional, right? I mean, originally, and b in this way b also would be like effectively like a two dimensional stuff, right? Because I mean. Okay, composite, but still characterized. So there is no other components of momenta, right?
Good. So the boundary is 1 plus 1 dimensional.
Yeah.
And we have two particles, so that gives us two quantum numbers, the momentum of each of the two. In the bulk, it's 2 plus 1 dimensional, so one particle has two quantum numbers, omega and k. And so the relation between those in this model is extremely intuitive. It's just omega in the bulk is the sum of the energies of the two boundary particles, and the momentum of the bulk particle is the difference in momentum between the two boundary ones.
I see.
In the real ADS CFT, it's it's much more complicated, obviously. So in fact, one can check so I said that the B's are these operators, so one can simply use the commutation relations on the boundary of the alphas, just the canonical commutation relations, and see what commutators one gets for the B's. So all I did is I took this alpha dot alpha and another alpha dot alpha and computed the commutator by just using that commutator alpha alpha as a delta function. And then I normal ordered. Normal ordered because everything is being done determinatively in 1 over n. And so what you get is a delta function to leading order and then a 1 over n piece which has some operators alpha tilde or alpha tilde and alpha dot alpha. And so this is what we expect. If the bulk field is truly free, then the B's should satisfy this commutation relation. BB dagger is a delta function. And then we know we have a free bulk field. And that's what we get to leading order. So without large N, it would clearly not work.
Imagine if there were, say, condensate of this alpha or alpha tilde, right? Even if it's kind of free field, but let's say that it's like a background, right? Then it would be one over n, of course, but still would be collection.
I mean, the leading piece would be different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's
your back reaction. Suppose in the bulk we took a black hole background and then did this precision in the black hole background.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the boundary we would have this thermal state of the alpha tildes, and so the commutation relations in the bulk would be specific to the black hole background. So these operators, the phis that we've constructed, behave in just the way that that the bulk operators do. And so in particular, they satisfy the bulk commutation relations. So 5, 0, 0 is the origin, commutes with all the local CFT operators. Since the local CFT operators are just the bulk operator here, the space like separated. It also commutes with small bilocals. So if you take any bilocal in the CFT, say phi dot pi or phi dot phi, stretching from here to here, then 5-0 commutes with it as well. In fact, you can make the bilocal up to half. It can stretch up to half across half the boundary. That this is true is manifest with the ADS-Rindler construction. The point being that one can write, when solving the bulk equations of motion, one can write 5-0 in terms of data on any half of the boundary. So one can represent 5-0 as an operator living here just by using an ADS-Rindler Green's function to evolve it to only this diamond, or an operator living on any half.
Just the leading order in 1 over n?
This is supposed to be true to all orders in 1 over n.
All orders.
Up to the dressing stuff, right?
By small bilocals, you mean?
Less than half.
But what would a big bilocal be then?
Half. So consider a bulk operator for a point here. Then small bilocals I would define as the size so that the diamond doesn't contain.
We're supposed to think there's a Wilson.
But so 5-0 in the center really commutes with all local and bilocal operators.
Except the bilocals that are exactly antipodal.
Exactly.
I mean just move the bulk point slightly away from the center and then it's clear. Okay, so this commutation property is obvious from the bulk perspective, because it's just a property of the Green's function for the wave equation. And on the boundary, it's puzzling that there are so many different, that lots of different operators they have support in different regions are really the same operator. So this puzzle was raised by Almeri, Dong, Carlo. You guys are even sitting in the
order. We're sitting in the right order.
and so their proposed resolution was that the operators are only the same on a code subspace. So one can ask in the context of this model I'm presenting, what would be the relevant subspace in which the operators would be the same. Again, I'm only doing this perturbatively in 1 over n. And so in this model, there's a very natural answer, which is the gauge invariant states, which really means the singlets. So, how can one see that this restriction to this space makes this possible, that many of these different Rindler precursors are really the same? The point will be that let Lij be the generator of global ON rotations. So here I'm referring to the boundary. So we rotate all the fields, all the phis in the same way, and so it's clear that phi dot phi and phi dot pi and pi dot pi will remain invariant. Sorry, that's not quite what I want to say. Let Lij be the generated global ON rotations, and so any gauge invariant state will be annihilated by Lij, sort of by definition. And so using Lij, one can then contract it into other things and construct operators which are not zero, but zero when acting on gauge invariant states. So it turns out that this is enough to, in this model, show that all the Rindle precursors are really the same. So I'm not going to show how we showed this, but let me just say which. So there are many operators one can build out of the Lij's that are zero on gauge invariant states. The particular ones we need to use are these. So one can form this kind of operator by doing the procedure I outlined. It's also omega plus here, alpha omega plus dot alpha tilde omega minus, and omega plus omega minus, the product is less than zero. So one of them is positive and the other is negative. In fact, and this is at infinite n. In fact, it's pretty clear anyway, without this, to see that this is zero on gauge invariant states. The point is that this operator annihilates the vacuum simply because one of these is a creation operator, the other is an annihilation operator. Its Hermitian conjugate also annihilates the vacuum. And at infinite n, all correlation functions factorize into two-point functions. And so this leaves all correlation functions invariant. So in fact, there's... So this was just a boundary statement. One can ask what this operator being zero translates into the bulk. And so if you recall the dictionary was b omega k, 1 over square root of n alpha omega plus tilde omega minus. So these things that are gauge equivalent to zero would be like bulk creation operators b omega k with omega less than k. Since alpha plus omega plus omega minus less than zero translates into omega less than k. And these operators don't exist in the bulk, obviously. They have energy less than momentum. I'm in the Poincaré fashion. Okay, but the point is that this gauge symmetry, the singular constraint, is enough to realize the ADH proposal that the operators, all the different Rindler precursors, are the same on code subspace, which for us is the gauge invariant space.
Sorry. What's L omega plus?
What's
alpha
omega plus alpha tilde. Yeah, alpha is the creation slash annihilation operator. Okay, so the summary. Is is in this model the bulk particle is two boundary particles, a superposition. We needed large N. And we needed gauge symmetry. And using these ingredients, we were able to construct at leading order 1 over n operators which behave like bulk operators. Yes?
Okay. I'm following the confusion. I've always thought gauge symmetry is a redundancy of your description. There's no physics in gauge transformations. You can imagine writing your theory in terms of gauge invariant operators, possibly non-complicated, non-local Lagrangian or whatever, but there should be nothing special about how you choose to introduce gauge. And now, but somehow you're saying that the gauge symmetry is playing an important role here. If I had the theory with just gauge invariant operators, you wouldn't be able to separate a code subspace. I'm just confused about why you're getting physics out of gauge symmetry.
It's true that by just picking a gauge, then the gauge theory becomes not a gauge theory. So there's presumably something special, if this is the correct vision, then there's something special about gauge theories, which I don't know exactly what it is.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood, because I thought you were just using the words gauge symmetry as an abusive language. In other words, these other operators exist, they just, you know, you're trying to identify a subspace of the full Hilbert space of the theory. There are other states, they're just not in the code subspace. So the full theory contains these other states, and the full operator algebra contains operators which are not invariant under ON.
That's fine, but the boundary we're taking to be ON. Yeah,
in other words, it's a global symmetry in the boundary theory.
So in the real CFT, the gauge symmetry is like the normal one, it's a local. It's a local real gauge symmetry. So one could add Wilson lines between so the bilocals, just put a Wilson line and make it a local gauge symmetry. So at leading order 1 over n, it won't change the story.
Sorry, I'm still confused. The boundary theory you said was just the free ON theory, the theory of the global symmetry.
Yeah.
You mean couple of the Chern-Simons and gauge symmetry, right?
Is it considering gauging the ON but turning off the strength of the gauge interaction so it's just projecting single sector?
That's right.
So asking Garrett's question in a different way, is not your code subspace the entire physical Hilbert space? So you haven't, it's not different on a code subspace, that's the whole Hilbert space.
So now we're back to the original puzzle. If you're saying they agree on all physical states, don't we run into trouble with A, D, and H?
There are two different code subspaces which are being talked about. There's one code subspace, which is the fact that the operators are being constructed perturbatively in 1 over n. So all these statements, so one of the points of ADH was that these statements that one makes about commutivity, you're taking some background geometry, and so if you consider a sufficiently excited state far away from the geometry you're talking about, then you lose your understanding of the bulk in whatever region you're interested in. And so in that sense, none of these statements, one cannot be certain that any of these statements are true for all states, meaning that they're true non-perturbative.
So you're putting a low energy restriction on.
Something like that.
In some sense, close.
That's what I mean by perturbatively in one
direction. And you're saying that's sufficient.
That's what we would say, is that it's sufficient.
Ah, okay. So if they agree for low energy states, you're fine.
Yes.
It's true they would say that's sufficient. However, even doing that here in this model, doing this, it's still puzzling. Even with the low energy states, it's still puzzling why you can write an operator here. It's the same as an operator here.
Yeah, it's not obvious you should be able to do it. I mean, I think there's room for everyone to be right here, right? Because
there's also room for everyone to be wrong.
Simultaneously?
mean, you know, yeah, so we would say, so the contradiction that we pose is resolved just by looking at the sets of states whose energies don't grow with n, in the sense that you can't make the argument for the contradiction anymore. But that's different from actually knowing how to write the precursor. You know, that just says that you don't know it doesn't exist, but it's still nice to have a situation where you actually know how to write it. And indeed, you know, although I completely agree with everything you said about gauge symmetry doesn't mean anything anyway, I mean, it is indicative that every single example we have of ADS CFD, I think we, in some sense, we naturally think of it as a gauge theory in the boundary theory. And there should be some more invariant version of that statement, but I mean, I think it's not a totally empty statement.
You wrote a paper called Gauge Gravity Duality.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one.
But sorry, in your model, what is the boundary theory? Is it a theory with a global O(n) center?
No, sorry. It's the O(n) model in the singlet sector, which you would construct
that's
by
the
gauging.
Whole theory. There's nothing else on the,
yes,
the boundary
the
theory that's physical.
That's it. Yes.
Well, we use these phrases global and gauge in a confusing way to mean two different things.
I don't mean global, sorry.
You can use global
gauge.
Symmetry can be global in the sense that X on the whole space-time, but you still choose to mod out by that symmetry, making it gauge in the other sense.
Well, I mean, my question was, are there physical states that are not invariant under O(n)? And your answer is
no.
No.
Yeah. So that's why you need the low energy restriction, too, to resolve the paradoxes. Which he's put in, because he's neglected terms with one over n's in them.
Yeah, but we could just interpret that as looking at the low energy sector of a theory with an O(n) global symmetry. That's looking at the singlet sector of a theory with O(n) symmetry.
Well, I mean, there is, but I think, it, I mean, he is working in the theory, I mean, the theory he's working in is a gauge theory. So, but this, so the non-singlets don't exist. But even in a gauge theory, so I would say even in a gauge theory, we can formulate our paradoxes, and they're just as strong.
Okay.
So then you need to get to the code subspace, you need an additional restriction, which he's also made.
But he's answering a different question than I thought you were answering in your paper, which is that, you know, that there are other operators in CFT.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, but I mean, it's still interesting.
Okay.
But when you're saying that the kind of gauge symmetry, it implies that certain kind of fields which appears on the boundary are not, I mean, are not physical, right? Don't contribute to this. So why, once you have an explicit construction, right, in terms of this alpha tilde, you know, in certain sense you can say what your gauge field is.
The gauge.
If you have something.
So I'm considering phi i's, and then the only things that have bulk duals are phi I dot phi I. So if you just take phi 1 or phi 2, then it has no bulk dual.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Okay, let me move on to the lattice. And then I think the lattice, the part of the lattice that's non-perturbative 1 over n, will connect in this sense more with what ADH were doing. Since there we'll try to construct the precursor non-perturbatively, and we won't succeed.
No, that's what Juan said.
What did Juan say?
we were discussing this with Juan last year, and he said that there's a sense in which you can think of the D1, D5 CFT as being a theory that's not a gauge theory, but has a gravity dual. Because you can think of it as a sigma model on the moduli space of instantons. Yeah, it would be counter to what I said. Yeah.
Okay, so now we're just going to take the boundary to live on a lattice with n sites. And we're going to try to construct recursives. So on the lattice, we can't construct the precursors by doing the same procedure we did before, evolving in the bulk and evolving on the boundary, since the boundary we have a lattice, so the dispersion relation is nonlinear. So the way we're going to try to construct precursors is from their defining property that they need to commute with a certain set of CFT operators. The set that's dictated by bulk locality. So in particular, as we already said, the focus will be on the bulk field, the precursor for the bulk field at the center, and that will need to commute with all bilocals stretching across less than half the boundary. So the goal will be to construct an operator that commutes with all bilocals stretching across less than half the boundary. So the general... So the most general operator we can write down so here I and j denote the site indices, and the sites run from 1 to squiggly n, which is different from capital N, which is very large, whereas squiggly n is just the number of sites. So the general The most general form of 5-0 that we can write down is something here where f, I, j, and g, r, j are something that needs to be determined.
Is there a reason why you can't contract pi with pi?
Yes, because if you make time run the other way, then that means that vanishes. It doesn't have it.
Yeah.
So we're going to fix... I'm just writing down the most general operator that one can have for the precursor, and now I'm going to pose that it needs to commute with all these small bilocals to try to fix Fij, Gij. And then the question will be, do we have enough freedom in the Fs and the Gs to actually make this possible? Okay, before doing that, I first want to impose the gauge symmetry. So recall to sort of reduce the number of variables here to remove the redundancy. So recall that the gauge symmetry meant alpha omega plus that alpha tilde. This is the one that I used before. Also, one has just left movers or just right movers.
Vlad, isn't that already gauge invariant automatically because of the dots?
Yes. Yeah. But there's more symmetry. In other words, I could modify this by adding some operators which are zero. Just in the same way there are multiple
variables. Okay.
That's right. And so I want to use that in the most convenient way at the start. So these other things that are also zero are left and left, right and right. So these are the gauge symmetries of momentum space. And again, they're very intuitive. They just come from the fact that you annihilate the vacuum both on the right and on the left. So one can ask what they look like in position space. So previously we had not asked what gauge symmetry looked like in position space, since we had done everything sort of in momentum space, where it's easier. And so one can write the Fourier transforms of the alphas, and so get equations in terms of phis and pis. And what one finds is that one can set Gij to 0. This is almost true. That all these equations amount to being able to set Gij to 0. It's almost true because you can't remove. It's true up to modes that have zero momentum parallel to the boundary, but I'm going to ignore it since it doesn't affect the argument. Okay, so the operator we're dealing with is.
You're putting in a restriction that it's at most quadratic in your fundamental boundary fields, and that you don't have other, you know, Fijk terms with coupling three.
But then it would be a singlet.
Well, quartic.
But you quartic.
Four.
Yeah, good. So quartic. That if you were doing high order in 1/n, then that would appear, but the leading order will not.
It will not. I'm just puzzled because all the sort of tensor network sort of models we've been hearing about have lattice boundaries, right?
Yes.
And so you're saying that they can't satisfy this property, this commutativity?
Well, he's not putting in the code subspace, right?
I'm going to be doing this perturbatively in 1/n.
Oh, you are.
I will do this perturbatively in 1/n. Then 10 minutes later, I'll do this non-perturbatively. In neither case will I get the result that I want, but.
So I'm confused about, I would have thought Gij is gauge invariant, so I'm kind of surprised that you could
Gij.
Set to almost zero.
Gij, but you agree that I can change the Fs and the Gs by gauge symmetry, just because I can...
No, because it's a global rotation, so the dot products cancel between phi I, phi j, and phi I, phi j. So
imagine you have a precursor that has support on this half of the boundary, one in the precursor. So then the Fs and the Gs, they vanish here. Now consider where it has support on this half, and the Fs and the Gs vanish here. So the Fs and the Gs are changed by adding. Because this gauge...
So you're saying different. You're saying there could be different representations in the same operator.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Easily write down the Gij pi fij sum Hij phi Fij. So then that just becomes some F squiggle Ij phi Fij. So you can write the second term just like the first term. You can make the Gij phi Fij as phi Ij phi Fij using gauge invariance.
So I mean, you're saying there are examples of this where F and G are non-zero, but the operator is zero.
That's good. Yeah. So take this alpha and write in terms of alpha is like integral phi plus pi, you know, over omega. So this equation turns into some equation that's an integral of some function times phi dot phi plus some other function pi dot pi, and that's zero.
So let me just see if I understand. This is all a consequence of the constraints that are associated with gauge symmetry?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is all making use of the constraints to...
And being at leading order in 1/n.
So what you're saying is that you can alter the order of F and G, or at least G, by adding things proportional to the constraints at leading order in 1/n.
These equations are the ones I'm using.
I think you explained this already, but I didn't understand completely why this was related to gauge symmetry. I thought the argument that these things were zero was just that you had an annihilation operator in there, and that was killing the vacuum, and that at leading order in 1/n, everything was...
So these approximately zeros mean that the matrix elements of those guys vanish on any state of energy order 1.
No, it means that it's zero on the gauge invariant state.
So to say you don't
know why is that important?
The matrix elements of all those operators vanish on every state, every single state.
at leading order 1 over n, yes.
But say you don't do the 1 over n expansion, then are there, so you say you want to do this exactly, then are there still
I'm going to do that in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Wait, okay, okay, okay.
Why? What, where was the singlet condition important in making these things kill the state?
Good. It is true that if I wrote alpha 1 omega plus dot alpha 1 omega minus, for example, then this would, if I don't do the dot, where omega plus omega minus is less than 0, so one's a creation operator, one's an annihilation. It is true that in this case, this also annihilates the vacuum on both the right and the left. That is true. But the gauge symmetry is needed for other reasons.
So it isn't needed for making those things approximately 0?
That is correct.
So what are the things that it's needed for?
You would not...
Can you consider correlation functions of these guys?
So to make the statement that what I'm saying, the correlation functions factorize into two-point functions. It's two-point functions of the gauge invariant operators. Let me come back to this. There's a better reason. I can't remember. Good. So this is the form of 5-0. Now I need to impose that it commutes with the small bilocals. So the possible bilocals are phi j, phi I dot phi j, and phi I dot phi j. So the 1 over square root of n is the normalize of the operators. So the commutators. So I'm going to be requiring that this commute with all these bilocals where these are the small bilocals. So let me first note that the commutators So since I'm working perturbatively in 1 over n, so I compute these commutators and then a normal order. And so it turns out that the commutator of phi dot phi with pi dot pi is suppressed by 1 over n. So it's 0 to leading order. So the only commutator that needs to be considered is between this operator and phi dot pi. Okay? So now we enforce... So we enforce that phi 0 commutes with small bilocals. As an example, let's suppose we want phi 0 to commute with bilocals that are separated, say, by two lattice sites. So let's say we want to commute with all bilocals of the form phi I dot phi I plus 2 and phi I dot phi I plus 2. So the number of these bilocals separated by two sites is 2n. N is the number of lattice sites, simply because, so the number of those is 2n. So if we want,
can you call it capital L just to?
No, but I can make it more squiggly. It's too late now. I can make it more squiggly. So to have phi 0 commute with all bilocals of size less than, of separation less than M. Less than, I guess I don't have to make this quickly. Separation less than M, there are two N M plus N equations. So for each separation, there are two N equations, two squiggly N equations, and there are M possible separations. So there are this many equations, and the number of free parameters we have, the Fijs, we have I less than or equal to J, so there are N plus 1 over 2 parameters. So the maximum that M can be is 1 makes this less than this. And the maximum one gets at large N is N is less than N over 4.
So I mean, the equations could now be independent.
It's true, but I'm assuming they are. They probably are. So what we conclude is that we can construct an operator which commutes with bilocals, with all bilocals stretching up to a quarter of the boundary. Whereas in the bulk, from the bulk, we expect that we should be able to make a commute with all bilocals going up to half of the boundary. And indeed, when we did the continuum model, we achieved this. Yet on the lattice, we can only do a quarter. So that's a little surprising. One could ask what would happen if one just took the continuum precursor, the one written as an integral f phi dot phi, and just discretize the f's, the phi's, and then, because that's just the discretization of the continuum one. The point is, it won't, you can do that, but it won't obey the correct commutation relations. Perhaps the point is, when you go from the continuum operator to the lattice, you remove large parts of the operator, which were relevant for the commutators. So maybe it shouldn't.
Does it do a better job as you refine the lattice? Yeah. I mean, error.
No, because here I got n over 4, and this is independent of n.
Yeah, but you required something to commute exactly.
No.
If you just transcribe the continuum operator to the lattice and compute the commutator you get, does it have the property?
Make the commutator.
Does it become scale
as the number of sites to some power, minus the power.
Something like that.
Uh-huh.
Is that?
I haven't tried that. That's a good point. Yeah, maybe that's the point. Would that fix it? I'm not sure.
Well, I guess I'm confused with whether the continuum model is actually the continuum version of this model. If it is, that had better be the case.
Yeah.
If they're different models, then, of course, it's unclear.
Okay. Let me now do the non-perturbative case. And there it is more, there it is clear that the lattice and the continuum are very different. So everything previously has relied on the 1 over n expansion in the sense that we try to construct operators which commute with the relevant operators, but only at perturbatively in 1 over n and more explicitly to leading order in 1 over n. So one can now ask, how far can we go if we just want the operators to commute exactly? So we're going to try to build such operators. So we'll again be on the lattice at site A. And the generator of O(n) rotations just at site A. is LA. So this is generative ON rotations at site A. So any ON invariant at A such as phi A, phi A, will commute with LAIJ. Okay? This LAIJ should not be confused with the LIJ previously, the LIJ that generates global rotations, that's the sum of LAIJs over all the sites A. Okay, now let me introduce some notation. So let Z alpha, so this will denote Z1, this will mean phi, and Z2, this will mean pi. I'm just grouping the fields phi and pi into one field Z. So now let's ask what the form of the precursor needs to be if we want to commute with all the with everything at site, with all the invariants at site one. So in this case, the precursor should be some function L1 ij So this will commute with all the invariants at site 1, simply because the only way site 1 appears is in terms of L1 ij, which commutes with all the invariants at site 1. So any function of this form will work for commuting with the invariants at site 1. So now we suppose we want the precursor to commute with all local gauge invariant operators at all of the sites except for one of the sites. I'm randomly going to say except site n. So the reason I'm excluding, I'm not requiring that it commutes with operators at site n, is because that's where the gravitational Wilson line. One can say one's putting it there. So in this case, the precursor needs to be a function of L1 ij, L2 kl, etc., L n minus 1, mn. And then site n appears in some other way. So the point is that sites 1 through n minus 1, they only appear as the L, the corresponding Ls. And so this operator will commute with all these guys at each of the sites.
So this is a very strong requirement non-perturbatively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just certainly perturbatively, we expect it's fine to confine these gravitational tails to things that are like Wilson lines. Mm-hmm. But non-perturbatively, requiring it to be almost point-like on the boundary could make this an exceedingly high energy operator.
Mm-hmm.
Something proportional, you know, energy proportional to 1 over the lattice spacing or something. Or some power, inverse power of the lattice spacing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you require it to commute exactly with everything on the boundary.
Right.
It's very strong.
I mean, an example of an operator that does this is a local operator at site n. Right? So there are operators like this.
True. Well, these operators do this.
Yes.
So, but it is true, maybe that's not the most physically appropriate thing to be imposing in the bulk, but it works here. And it's the... So we succeeded in writing an operator that commutes with all the locals non-perturbatively. So the next thing we're going to try to do is write an operator that commutes with the bilocals, but the bilocals just between nearest neighbors. So gradually we'd like to build up and include all the bilocals we need to include, but we're going to start with next to nearest neighbor, with nearest neighbors. So like phi a plus one. So things like that. So the way to construct the precursor now is to note that the generator of an O-N rotation at sites A and sites A plus one, the same rotation. Is just L A I J. Plus LA plus 1, IJ. Okay? So for the precursor to commute with the bilocal stretching between sites 1 and 2, we need it to be of the form L1 plus L2, IJ. So almost the same logic as before. The only combination in which sites 1 and 2 appear is as L1 plus L2.
I mean, it's clear that that will have the property that you want, but is it clear that that's the only thing?
I think so. Maybe it's not clear. I don't know. So now let me require that instead it commutes with the operators, with the bilocals between sites 2 and 3. So then it's just the same thing, L2 plus L3. But now I want to impose the requirement that it commutes with bilocal stretching between sites 1 and 2 and bilocal stretching between sites 2 and 3. And in this case, the only thing that we could think of what to write down would be L1 IJ plus L2 IJ plus L3 IJC. So this will commute with bilocal stretching between sites 1 and 2 and bilocal stretching between sites 2 and 3. It will also, however, commute with bilocal stretching between sites 1 and 3, which is an unintended consequence. And indeed, I'm not certain that it's not possible to write one that doesn't, though I don't see how. But the point is that if one continues this procedure, just saying it needs to commute with bilocal stretching between nearest neighbors, one concludes that, following this logic, that the precursor should be of the form L1 plus L2. So sites 1 through n minus 1 appear in this combination. And so unintentionally, it now commutes with all bilocals stretching anywhere between sites 1 and n minus 1. And in fact, this combination, L1 plus L2 plus Ln minus 1, this is just equal to Lij minus Ln ij, where L was the sum of all the L's.
Which is 0.
Exactly. Which is 0, and so this operator is really a local operator. It's really a local operator at site n. And so this is consistent with the conjecture of AD and H, that if an operator commutes with all local operators except one at site N, then that operator is really a local operator at that site. And that seems to be what we're coming. Anyway, so the point seems to be that that we cannot construct a lattice precursor non-perturbatively. In fact, in this case on the lattice, this conclusion is obvious. It's obvious because it's obvious for this reason: phi 1 dot phi 3 is commutator. Phi 1 dot phi 2, phi 2 dot phi 3. And so, if you require that an operator commutes with nearest neighbors, then you generate next to nearest neighbors, since non-perturbatively the algebra of the bilocal generates the entire algebra. So this statement that I just made is true non-perturbatively in 1 over n, but it's false perturbatively in 1 over n, since the 1 over n powers are different. Scalings are different on the left and on the right, which is why perturbatively in 1 over n we were able to succeed, but non-perturbatively we fail. So that's it. So there were three parts. The first was, the point was to that in the CFT there the bulk tells us that there are operators which have somewhat remarkable commutativity properties, and so then we can take a simple model where we just take the boundary to be free, work in the continuum and the bulk on the boundary, and construct operators which have these properties. Working again perturbatively in 1 over n on the lattice, it seems we can only partially achieve this, and non-perturbatively we can't. So there still remains the interesting question of how to construct the precursor for the entanglement wedge, which is perhaps answerable in this model since it's simple, but we don't have the answer yet.